Want a chance to win 250 pounds in vouchers? All you have to do is fill out the Ballpark's listener survey. It takes just 15 minutes. The Ballpark podcast is celebrating our 10th anniversary in 2026. And after more than 130 episodes covering U.S. politics, we want to hear from you to shape our next decade. So hit the link in the show notes for the survey details and prize draw terms and conditions. Share your thoughts, and you could be 250 pounds better off.
Hello, and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, managing editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. Like his first, Donald Trump's second presidential term has been a challenge for Europe, the EU, and its leaders. Trump has called for NATO allies in Europe to contribute more of their budgets to their own defense, and has threatened to take over Greenland, an autonomous territory of Denmark. And while Trump's foreign policy record has not been very successful elsewhere, as wars continue to rage in Ukraine and in the Middle East, the exception is in Europe, which Trump seems to want to divide and weaken. Europe's response in turn has been largely deferential towards Trump, with some leaders flattering the president, but others, including Spain, Denmark, and Norway, pushing back more forcefully. To discuss the discordant relationship between Donald Trump and Europe and how it can start to build relationships beyond the US, in March 2026, I spoke to Professor Natalie Tocci. She's professor of practice at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies and director of the Institute for International Affairs in Rome. I began our conversation by asking Professor Tocci to outline their research and current work.
So I'm Natalie Tocci. I am professor of practice at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. I also have a research affiliation in Bocconi University, and I'm ending up actually my term as director of the Institute for International Affairs in Rome. I'm kind of all things Europe and Europe in the world. And geographically, I focus a lot on obviously transatlantic relations, but also Europe's role in Eastern Europe, in the Middle East. And thematically, I've done quite a bit of work on both security and defense issues, as well as climate and energy.
Thank you so much. So my first question is really quite simple. How would you say Donald Trump's second term has impacted US-EU relations overall so far?
It's been a fairly dramatic impact, I guess. And I think what's interesting is trying to sort of figure out what the differences in terms of that impact are between the first Trump administration and the second. So there are some elements, obviously, of similarities. In the first Trump administration, we saw the way in which the United States had basically taken a step back from openness and free trade in particular, and the sort of phase of increasing protectionism in the United States has really been going on for over a decade. So I guess that has continued. And I think the other element, which is in some respects kind of similar, although more acute now than it was back then, is the step back from multilateral institutions, and in particular with the withdrawal from all sorts of international organizations and international treaties. In that first Trump administration, probably the most acute manifestation of that step back was actually something which has come back to haunt us now, which was back in 2018, the US withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. And it's really that moment which essentially triggers a cycle of vicious cycle that we're in now and has ended up in war. So I think in some respects, there are similarities between that first moment and the second moment. And the reason why I say this is that the transatlantic relationship managed to overcome that first trauma. But if we then add on to that first Trump administration, what is new in the second Trump administration, I think it becomes clearer that it's actually harder to navigate this particular storm. And what's different, I think, now are, I think, two sets of things. On the one hand, there is the growing illiberalism and I would say authoritarianism within the United States itself. And this is something that is not simply confined to the US, but we see the way in which the United States is very actively supporting precisely those same parties, movements, governments in Europe itself. So there's this element of democracy, which I think was not present in the first Trump administration, and I think opens the space for a much deeper deeper structural break between the two sides. And then second and related is that the second Trump administration seems to pursue, in a sense, a vision of what I would define as imperial collusion. Whereas the first Trump administration, this was really a story about the growing competition between the United States and China, which then once we end Trump one and end up in Biden, it takes, in a sense, a more normative form. This is about democracy versus autocracy. Now, moving on to Trump two, there doesn't seem to be a lot of that competition and rivalry going on. There seems to be far greater focus on the one hand, managing those relations, be it the US and China, be it indeed a sort of return and reconciliation when it comes to US and Russia. And most of the aggression, in many respects, seems to be towards kind of friends and allies and in this kind of pursuit of empire, actually, in a very predatory way. So I think both the democracy piece and the sort of predatory empire seeking piece are definitely two novelties of the second Trump administration, which means that the impact on transatlantic relations is much deeper.
So you've written in The Guardian about the failures of European leaders to stand up to Trump's foreign policy elsewhere in the world, such as with Venezuela, Gaza, and even closer to home with Greenland. Why have European leaders not pushed back more strongly against Trump? And what consequences has this had and is having for Europe itself?
So, good question. I mean, why haven't they pushed back more? And I think what's troubling about this question is that 1 year ago, just after Trump took office, I think there was a legitimate question to be asked, what is the smart way of handling Trump? And what actually Europeans were hearing from many American friends, particularly, I wouldn't say necessarily MAGA, because there are no MAGA friends of Europe, but let's say MAGA adjacent, sort of once upon a time, traditional Republicans restyled. So what Europeans were hearing from these kinds of Americans was precisely the message of, you need to flatter Trump. This is what works. So I would say a year and a half ago, it was a legitimate tactic to pursue. You flatter, you try and contain his excesses, you try and buy time, you play along when you can, and ultimately the storm will pass. What I find troubling is that Europeans have been pursuing this strategy, and it doesn't seem to me that it has had a great effect, or rather it has had effect, but not exactly as planned and desired by Europeans. And other countries have actually been taking a different approach and have been demonstrating far greater willingness to sort of stand up and retain an element of dignity. And actually, these are the countries that have fared better. So if you compare how, I'm not even talking about China here, because China, you could immediately say to me, well, obviously China's got cards that Europeans don't have. So let's just put China to one side and focus on the reaction of the likes of Canada or Mexico or Brazil or India. And in different shapes and forms, I think that all of these countries have actually demonstrated greater will to sort of stand up, and they have actually gained more, both domestic and internationally. So then the question is, so why is it that Europeans keep on with the flattery, even if it doesn't exactly keep the US on side on Ukraine, even if they end up being dragged in a war which they themselves now recognize as illegal in the Middle East, even if the Greenland threat is maybe temporarily suspended, but it's definitely not been retracted, even if we end up with a really trade deal. So why is it that the flattery continues? And I guess part of the answer leads us in, well, you have all of these dependencies, but I deliberately focused on these comparisons with other countries. I mean, if we take particularly countries in Latin America that are also extremely dependent on the United States, in some respects, even more dependent on the United States. And so I feel that the kind of objective material, if you like, explanation, whether we're looking at it in economic terms or in security terms, is necessary but insufficient. And there seems to me to be a whole other dimension of this explanation, which is probably actually more in the realm, not even of ideas and ideology, but of psychology. There's this kind of element of learned helplessness that Europeans have when it comes to the United States, and simply not managing to conceive that the United States is not simply taking a step back and disengaging a little bit, but may actually end up being an adversary, threatening European countries. And this is, I think, something that Europeans really, really struggle to kind of hold in their minds and act upon.
So have there been certain European states which have been more resistant to Trump's efforts to divide the continent? I know a lot of folks have talked about Spain, especially recently. How have they handled him better than some of the others?
So let's take the case indeed of Spain. I would add Denmark and perhaps Norway too. And I think these are probably the three countries which have indeed manifested greater willingness to say, I draw the line here. So obviously in the case of Denmark, this was the most pro-American country in Europe. We often forget it, but it's really incredible the way in which Trump has managed to transform the most pro-US country and probably the most anti or skeptical of the United States. And Mette Frederiksen, socialist leader in Denmark, basically said, this is where I draw the line. The sovereignty and territorial integrity of the Kingdom of Denmark cannot be threatened. And she has been extremely outspoken in basically saying, if the United States proceeds on this threat, NATO is dead. I mean, literally. And this has actually paid off for her. Denmark is approaching elections. With elections, you never know what the outcome is, but the polls suggest that actually her party's doing very well. So it actually suggests that there's a domestic political return to standing up. In some respects, actually, we can make a similar argument of other elections. Take the one in Canada or in Australia. In both cases, the pro-Trump candidate that was the favored in elections lost. So there's this kind of perverse Trump effect, a Trump embrace that ends up killing populists. So I think the case of Denmark suggests that when you do stand up, there are political returns, domestic political returns in doing it. I think the case of Spain is also an extremely interesting one, because whereas in the case of Denmark, it is Denmark that is being threatened, in the case of Spain, you basically see Pedro Sanchez taking a consistently, let's say, not anti-US, but anti-Trump approach to a number of issues. Whether we're talking about Gaza, whether we're talking about Venezuela, whether we're talking about now Iran, Spain has been really consistent. And by the way, Spain also obviously supports Ukraine and continues to support Ukraine. Obviously, it does not support Ukraine in the way in which, say, Poland does, but geography ultimately will always have some degree of influence. But Spain has also, interestingly, said no to Trump when it comes to 5% defense spending. And it's not as if on that defense spending front, Spain has done nothing. Spain is spending 2%. This is what the commitment was. And Spain is spending 2% being the OECD economy, which is growing the fastest. So one thing is spending 2% if you're not growing at all. One thing is spending 2% if you're growing at 3.6%. So I think it's an interesting case because it has been a consistently principled approach. And I think what's kind of fascinating about it is that as other European countries, let's say more core European countries, France and Germany, Italy, UK, and here I'm not European Union countries, but kind of understanding Europe more broadly, have basically kind of been ambiguous, have been cowardly in many respects. This is not paying off for them. If I think about my own Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, an ally of Donald Trump, she is increasingly kind of silent and embarrassed about all this. So I think there's really something to be said about standing up and both domestic political returns, but also the international positioning that this gives you. And last point, actually, what you also notice is that when you do stand up and Trump may threaten you, he doesn't actually follow through with those threats. He had threatened Spain of a trade embargo because Spain had not conceded the use of bases for the US's attack on Iran. Has that happened? No. I mean, that threat has just disappeared. So if you kind of have the guts and the stamina to just kind of say no and just say no, I mean, most of the time, these threats are simply going to blow over because Donald Trump is not exactly a very credible leader in world affairs.
So the bear in the room when we talk about Europe is, of course, Russia and its war in Ukraine. How does Moscow factor into Trump's plans for European and even maybe global order? And what consequences has this had for the rest of Europe?
So this is really where I kind of come back to my view that I think what really characterizes in many respects US foreign policy under the second Trump administration is a vision of imperial collusion. We have seen the way in which the United States has sided with Russia over this war. This has been really rather consistent over the course of the last year, from the dressing down of Vladimir Zelensky in the Oval Office through to the 20-point plan for Ukraine, which was kind of written more in Moscow than in Mar-a-Lago, and all the way now to the US basically lifting oil sanctions on Russia in the context of the war on Iran. Basically, the United States wants to have a good relationship with Russia. It sees Russia as a great power. And Ukraine is this kind of annoying little inconvenience. So in the same ways, you see the way in which Trump looks up to Xi Jinping. And obviously, there's a competitive element to this relationship. But I think what really tends to prevail so far is Trump's desire to somehow manage this relationship, which I'm not necessarily saying is a bad thing. Of course, managing relations is a good thing. But you see the way in which Trump's world is a world of strongmen, and the ideology, which is not necessarily his, but the ideology which is then framed under him, and particularly, you know, expressed in the national security strategy, is a world of empires. It's a world of raw power in which the United States is the first of those empires. Then there's the Chinese. Then there's the Russians, and then there are the colonies. And the problem with Europe is that it is really understood in many respects as being colonizable, be it Eastern Europe by Russia, be it Western Europe by the United States. And Trump doesn't seem to have a fundamental problem with the idea that Russia may have its sphere of influence, not just in Ukraine, but probably elsewhere in Eastern Europe, because this is the worldview that he himself espouses, right? As I said, a world of imperial collusion.
A question for you. Have you filled out the ballpark survey yet? It's just 15 minutes, helps us get ready for our 10th anniversary, and if you're lucky, you might win £250 in vouchers.
So moving on to where we are, we're in the UK right now. What role does the UK play in managing or maybe failing to manage the European response to Trump?
So perhaps just two reflections here. I think first point to be made is that, given that I tend to be quite dark on everything, so let's just kind of start off with a slightly lighter point, or brighter, I should say, that the Trump factor has actually led to a structural convergence between the United Kingdom and the rest of Europe, and in particular the European Union. I don't think that we would have seen the reset in relations had it not been, not just for war on the continent and therefore the threat from Russia, but also the challenge posed by the US's abandonment / betrayal. So I think that this is real, and I think that this is happening. At times, both Brussels and London, I must say at this point in time, probably more Brussels than London, kind of get caught up in silly, petty points. I mean, just think about what is still a failure to reach an agreement over the UK's participation in the SAFE program. So this is the loan program worth $150 billion for the joint procurement of weapons in Europe. So I'm not suggesting here that it all is well and good, but I do think that there is a genuine willingness on both sides to kind of realign and reconverge, given the broader strategic predicament that we're in. In terms of the UK's role in the handling of Trump, given that amongst European countries, the UK is probably one of the most dependent on the United States. And of course, there has been the special relationship and so on and so forth. So essentially, the UK has definitely tilted more towards the, let's say, ambiguity and the tendency to kind of bend the knee. I don't think that this is and feels comfortable for particularly this British government, particularly this British prime minister that is basically kind of used as Trump's laughingstock every other day and punching bag. So I think it's deeply uncomfortable. And this is also why I kind of come back to this sort of psychological state of mind. It's really tough to sort of come to terms with the fact that the special relationship is no longer so special. Perhaps it's a little bit too special, right? But not exactly in ways that are very desirable. And it takes a while to make that mental switch. I find that, and this is not just a point about the UK, but perhaps more broadly, that there is this recognition often in private conversations, but that private recognition amongst leaders often still fails to translate both at collective level and at institutional and public level. And so I don't know whether this is just a time lag problem or whether there is this deeper mismatch between private recognition and public acknowledgement.
Thank you. And could you talk a bit more about maybe some of the domestic pressures in some of these EU countries that are kind of stopping that from happening?
I think, broadly speaking, European publics would like to see leaders that are better able to stand up. And so I don't think that the reason why they are not standing up is because they fear that they would, I don't know, lose public support. In fact, I think that, I was hinting at this point earlier, sort of sucking up to Trump has actually not been a very smart electoral strategy. And you even see far-right parties, I'm thinking about the Rassemblement National in France or even the AfD in Germany, that when kind of Trump goes ahead and threatens Greenland, they kind of say no. So I don't think that the explanation as to why Europeans are being so meek really has to do with public opinion. If anything, public opinion would be pushing in the opposite direction. I think it has more to do with these inbuilt institutional mechanisms. Institutions, you can almost consider them as kind of collective people. And there is a way of doing things. There are inbuilt assumptions in institutions. And one of the core inbuilt assumptions, be it in British government, be it in the European Union and the bureaucracy in Brussels, let alone be it in NATO, is that the United States is a friend. It's an ally. And it's not just an assumption which is kind of out there. It's an assumption that translates itself into laws and regulations and practices. And this is why I think that there is a real difficulty that leaders have that are simply, you know, at the kind of tip of these machines to act publicly and institutionally on the basis of something that their own public opinions recognize, and probably they themselves on an individual level recognize too. But still, the machinery has not made the shift to a different world.
And now just looking to the future, what major challenges do you think Europe will need to overcome if it wants to stop Trump's unmaking of regional ties and cooperation? How might it achieve that goal?
So I would say two things. Firstly, Europe needs to equip itself to confront Russia and stop and then deter war on the European continent against Russia without America. And it's a tall order, but it's not an impossible one to meet. I fundamentally disagree, for example, when I hear NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte essentially saying, forget Europeans defending themselves alone. Because I think his point, his metric of comparison is the United States. Now, of course, Europeans will never have the capabilities that the United States has on defense, but they don't need them. All, quote unquote, that Europeans need is enough to confront Russia alone. And frankly speaking, it's not exactly as if we're talking about a formidable enemy here. Yeah, I mean, this is a country that after 12 years of war in Ukraine has only been able to occupy 20% of the country. It is a country whose economy is just over the size of Spain's. It is a declining power in every shape or form. It is not a formidable enemy. So all we need to do is be better than Russia, right? It's not that hard. I mean, okay, I don't want to sort of underestimate the difficulties here, but simply say that I don't think we should be comparing ourselves to the United States, because Europeans are not going to be in the business of confronting China militarily or waging war on Iran. Like, this is not what Europeans will be doing. We just need to be kind of laser focused on, militarily speaking, I think actually on the Russia threat. So that's one thing that we should be doing. And I deliberately referenced Europe because I think that the recipe has various ingredients. I think, yes, of course, we should be working on developing a European pillar in NATO. I think that, yes, we should be working on bolstering what the European Union can do on defense. And I think that we should be working on formalizing the different coalitions of the willing and able that we have seen emerging, be it in the context of Ukraine, be it in the context of Greenland, for example, and perhaps perhaps dusting off the shelf ideas, for example, a European Security Council. So I think that all of these things should be pursued at the same time, and I actually think that they are within reach. So that's one element. A second element in terms of what we should be doing is actually working with not only the rest of the West, so the Canadas, Japans, Australias, etc. of this world, but the rest of the West with the rest. And so this is really where we get into the discussion about developing principled partnerships with countries in the global South, be it focused on climate questions, on digital questions, obviously on trade. I think that this is actually a really interesting trade moment. If you think that over the last year, the European Union has managed to sign, and in the case of Mercosur, even ratify trade agreements with Mercosur, with India, with Indonesia. It is negotiating with Australia, with the UAE, with a host of other countries. And this would not have happened had it not been for Donald Trump. So I think that we see elements both on what Europe should be doing internally, particularly on security and defense, and what Europe should be doing externally with the rest of the world. There are some little sort of seeds of hope, even if and as we haven't exactly, when it comes to the United States, been showing our kind of best colors.
Thank you. Well, I think that's a great place for us to finish. But before we do finish, I'd just like to give you the opportunity to direct our listeners' attention to any recent or upcoming books, articles, or other projects you're working on that you think they might find to be of interest.
Well, actually, given that we're on a podcast, let me actually promote a little bit of competition here. So together with my friend and colleague, Amanda Sloat, several months ago, we launched a podcast called Power and Purpose. And what we do on the show is generally invite women. I must say it's not a women-only show, but it's a women-mainly show, current or former leaders. And the aim is, yes, obviously talking about international relations and depending on who we're talking about. Actually, just earlier, I was doing a recording with a wonderful Indian MP, but we also talk about their personal choices. And what is it that actually doesn't go quite according to plan? Because especially, I think, sort of our younger listeners, and I'm sure this is the case even for this show, you kind of listen to these people and they're like, wow, amazing people. Like, they look at their CV, it's so kind of great, and there are no blanks. And actually, behind the perfect CV, there are all sorts of unexpected detours, there are failures, there are coincidences. And just to kind of get a little bit behind the curtains of, and kind of giving these stories is something that I've enjoyed enormously doing. And yeah, so it'd be great for your listeners to sort of perhaps look onto Power and Purpose too.
Well, listeners should definitely check out Power and Purpose, and we'll be linking to that in our show notes as well. Just remains for me to say, Professor Natalie Tocci, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark today.
Thank you.
Natalie Tocci is Professor of Practice at Johns Hopkins University, School of Advanced International Studies, and Director of the Institute for International Affairs in Rome. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Professor Natalie Tocci for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan US Centre, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On X and Instagram, we're at @LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson at Navin Fatah. A theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and like lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. You can email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @LSE_US. And tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan US Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.
Play ball!